Okay, points made on both sides there. Okay, lady at the front.
Morning, Edna Elliott McCall. I was just wondering what will happen to the national debt that we have if Scotland becomes independent. Will we be taking over a portion of that as we would do the pensions?
Well, the answer to that is nobody knows because, you know, it's not happened before. But the feeling is that what you would do is you'd split it either in share of GDP or population share. So, yes, we would take on debt. Alex Salmond has said that if we can't get into a currency union, he intends to default on it, which is not the best way to start off life as a new country. But I can't. Nobody can give you the definitive answer because it's like so many other things. You'd have to have a discussion about it. And, you know, as you know, the nationalist government is producing a white paper which is supposed to answer all of these questions, which we think is coming out either on the 18th of September or the beginning of October. So my guess is it will have as many answers then as we've got today.
Okay. Thank you.
Can I look for just... there's a gentleman at the back. Just before you begin, sir, any other questions? So I may take a few at the one time. Okay, I'll take Bruce after that one. And then you'll take three questions just now. One... to Bruce, and then the gentleman here at the front. Okay, sir?
Eric Emsley. I am a committed unionist, and really nothing that will be said between now and next year is going to sway my opinion. But I do worry about the undecided at the moment and how you intend to persuade them of your views. Because I don't see anything really coming over that would influence the ordinary man in the street to understand all these complex pictures. What exactly are you proposing to do to make people understand a bit better the implications of what may happen in a year's time? Thank you.
Thank you, Eric. Bruce?
Well, my question is completely different, but Bruce Cartwright, PwC. I'm intrigued by the sort of historical significance of Scotland saying we go independent because historically we came into this. But it doesn't really stop there because Scotland as a unit wasn't really as a unit. You take the Shetland-Orkney argument, they also were not part of the wider Scotland at some point. So surely if you take the first logic that you have a right to independence at one level, is it right that Shetland-Orkney could equally say we have a right to independence of that unit? And take whatever oil subsidies, etc., they take with it. And it just seems to me that no one's willing to actually say to the islanders whether the same logic applies, but I can't see why it wouldn't.
Okay, thanks, Bruce. Last one.
Ian Wright, retire. I would like to ask a subsequent question, but one I would wish
one
to ask.
One question.
I promise. You did refer to the events in Parliament on Thursday evening, briefly. I realise that that is indirectly, but related to the topic that you've been speaking to today. My question is, have you any considered view on the impact on each of the UK political parties, and with that I would include UKIP and the SNP, on the impact in the longer term of Thursday night's actual vote and the proposed, which was then defined and I hear in this morning, possibly to be reinstated next week, subsequent vote in Parliament next week.
Okay. Right, let me deal with the three points. Can I start with the Orkney and Shetland point? Whether or not people stay within the United Kingdom or Orkney and Shetland state as part of Scotland, you know, it's really, you know, a matter for them at the end of the day. What we choose to do. I mean, you know, I've never argued that Scotland doesn't have the right to vote to be independent. Of course it has. Where I think you have a slight difficulty within what is now Scotland in starting to go through Scotland saying, well, this bit voted for independence, that bit didn't. The country then breaks up and becomes sort of balkanised. I think that's less likely. I'm well aware that Orkney and Shetland, you know, the for obvious reasons, you know, they feel very detached from the central belt of Scotland. You know, half my family comes to the Western Isles of Scotland, and they, you know, at times will look at Edinburgh and look at London and say, well, actually, London is closer to us than, you know, than is Edinburgh. And I think it's unlikely as a practical proposition that Orkney and Shetland would break off, because as many other of the considerations I touched on in relation to Scotland would apply, you know, in bucket loads to island communities like that. In relation to the persuasion point, if you like, firstly, I don't assume that people in Scotland as a whole find arguments like pensions or currency to be so complicated that they sort of turn off. We, like the other side, you know, as you do in campaigns, we do a lot of polling to find out what people are thinking and why they think. And perhaps you just make a point about a referendum that's an important one. In a general election, at the beginning of the campaign, all the political leaders will say to you, this is a very important election, the most important ever, and every single vote counts. And actually, they don't mean that. What they mean is every vote counts in a handful of marginal seats. And actually, political parties know those marginal seats. They actually almost know the voters they've got to turn, because, you know, we have very good records for those seats that are marginal. A referendum is completely different, not just because of the fact that every vote really does count, whether you're in the north, in Shetland or Dumfries, Edinburgh, Glasgow, you know, your vote's of equal value. But also, one of the things is that if you ask people if you're going to vote yes or no, you very often find the reasons for it are quite complex, and that people, you know, they think about these things in different ways, not just in terms of, well, how does that affect me and my job and so on. They feel about, emotionally, how do they feel about Scotland? They look at all sorts of things, some of which have been raised here today. And although the number of people who don't know, if you like, is still substantial, I reckon there's about 1.25 million whose votes are fluid at the moment, you know, a lot of the polling, public and private, is showing that people are beginning to harden up in their views. But, you know, it may interest you to know that the three things that have cut through, because a lot of, you know, politics, it won't surprise you to know, just washes over people. They just turn off. The three things that actually have cut through is, one is we were not told the truth about the European question, and that really did affect, and that affects, therefore, their credibility. The second one actually is pensions, which, you know, you lot had more to do than we did. And it's not surprising, because pensions are something people can relate to, because most people hope to get a pension. And it's not just the occupational pensions, but it's also, I don't know if you remember John Swinney's paper that said that because of the ageing population and the fact you didn't have the UK Treasury behind it, he questioned the sustainability of the state pension. That, you know, that one has cut through. The other one is currency. Now, if you'd asked me 5 years ago, would currency be an issue, I'd have said, well, it'd be quite difficult. But when you think about it, the European single currency and its travails have been in the news, you know, this time it was on every night. But certainly, it's hardly a month goes by. So when you start talking about currency unions, people have a better view of it or understanding of it than they might have had, you know, a few years ago. And people do worry about, well, will I have the pound? What currency will I have? So these are arguments that we just have to keep developing. I've seen someone earlier who said, he was, you know, saying, well, you know, when is the campaign going to get more exciting? That's a good question, actually. I'm afraid if you look at these things, there's no point in trying to run a sort of razzmatazz general election style campaign for 2 years. I mean, even the Americans don't spend 2 years electing their president. You know, it may seem that way at times. They don't actually do it. They're very isolated events in different states where, you know, it's quite different. But obviously, as you get closer to September next year, you know, both sides will up the ante. And, you know, that will, you know, the usual sort of excitements and so on will build up. Although my view is, rather like general elections, they tend to be won in the 2 years before the polling rather than in the last 2 or 3 weeks. So we shall see. That brings me to your point, which I think, simply put, you were saying that if there was some sort of military intervention, for example, would that affect, you know, what was happening? Or did I misunderstand you?
If I may, I am concerned that from what I've read and heard frequently since Thursday, the Prime Minister has lost credibility, widely and worldly, and the events of Thursday and perhaps the next fortnight are being and have been compared to suicides in terms of the effect on Britain's foreign policy.
Oh, I see. Right. Well, for those of you who didn't hear that, what you are asking about is, following last Thursday, you compared it to Suez in terms of the UK standing. I'm not sure I would go that far. I think what this is slightly different from the main argument at hand. But I think what you saw last Thursday was the very long shadow that Iraq has cast across not just British politics, but US politics as well, because President Obama has changed his position from where he was, a week or so ago. My own view, is that I can't honestly think how what was described as a limited military intervention could possibly do any good. And if you're dealing with people who are quite indiscriminate in the way that the population is being murdered, the idea you could have sort of shot across the bows, as Obama put it, I just don't understand that. And if you actually seriously did want to remove the capability of doing that, you're talking about quite a heavy military engagement. You've also got to bear in mind that if you look at some of the people operating in Syria, you may think Assad is bad, but these people are, just as bad on the other side. And I just think the issue is altogether more complex than was Suez. I think that the only other thing I'd say is that, there was a vote last week. I think we can be reasonably certain that there will be further atrocities, and at some stage, this issue is going to come back to us again as to what exactly we do about it. But that's a rather different issue, I think, from the one about, the debate about independence.
Thank you, Alistair. Okay, I've looked for several questions here. I have gentlemen there, 1, 2, 3, I'll take 4 here, 2, 3, 4, yeah, I think that's important, yeah. Start at the back.
Hi, Ian Bringan. I just had one comment. I find most of your arguments very compelling, I guess. The one sort of argument I've heard that I'd be keen to get your view on, your counter-argument to, is the suggestion that given the potential for a UK referendum on membership of the European Union, that you could potentially argue that being an independent Scotland is the best way to remain in the European Union, given the agenda being driven south of the border. And, we've obviously highlighted how important Europe is, and I'd be keen to remain part of that. And just wanted to hear how your arguments would play in that context.
Okay, one gentleman here.
Got it. I'm Paul Pomponi. Paired together, a lot of people would like more devolution, but short of independence. Why not invent together for max? And I guess it's mainly the Scottish Labour Party invent together. Is it because that would denude London of Labour MPs?
Okay, thank you. Gentlemen over here. I'd like to just stand or pass that.
Follow this, Alistair. Yep. Morning, Ewan Bruce. A question relates to nationality and passports and your opinion on what the status would be of a UK passport and whether people in Scotland would have a choice. Could they retain their UK passport, or would they, by default, have a new Scottish passport and no choice?
Okay, I'm going to pause it there. We'll come back to the other questions in a minute.
Okay. All right. Firstly, in the question of a referendum on a membership of the European Union. Remember, the Scottish referendum is a dead cert. It's going to take place on 18th September next year. Whether or not we have a referendum in relation to the European Union depends, firstly, on the outcome of the next general election. And then, secondly, there is still that mood to have a referendum. It's a bit more uncertain. And the thing about the debate about the European Union is it ebbs and flows. It's quite quiet just now. But for example, if UKIP were to do well next summer, which they could well do, in the European elections next year, then the whole thing might well up again. I just say a couple of things to you. One is, I don't know, but if you look at the polling, Scotland is marginally less Eurosceptic than is the whole of the UK, but we still have a lot of Eurosceptic people living in Scotland. The second thing is that if we were to vote to become independent, and if then the rest of the UK were to vote to leave the UK, and we stayed in the European Union, we'd almost certainly have to use the euro. Now, you think about it, if we were using the euro, and our biggest customers, or the number of customers, would still be next door in England. You know, it would cause quite a lot of difficulty, I think. And of course, then that all presupposes that actually the referendum in the whole of the UK or in England would go against membership of the European Union. I'm not so sure it would. You know, I said earlier this year that I thought it was rather like the Scottish referendum. Part of it in Scotland, the nationalists have done very well because for years no one ever challenged them. Someone just said things and people say, oh yeah, that must be right. Similar in relation to Europe, I happen to think we are better together as part of the European Union, but the argument's not really been made at the moment because, you know, we last had a referendum 40 years ago. In relation to the devolution and Devo Max, the great thing about Devo Max is that nobody knows what it means. You know, when people say, you know, do you want more? People say, of course I want more. You know, again, you know, I can tell you from the polling we did over a year ago, because I wanted to find out how important this third option was. And, you know, people said it wouldn't actually make any difference to how they voted. But when you asked what did people want devolved, do you know, near the top of the list was the NHS. Now, the NHS is 100% devolved at the moment. And then when you start probing people further and say, well, people say, yeah, I want welfare devolved. Well, do you? Because if you do, bear in mind that if you take all the revenues that Scotland would get from its income tax and North Sea oil together, they just about, but not quite, sum to what we spend on welfare in this country. So, you know, you just look at the sums, look what it means, you know, if you're taking that risk, if you like, that obligation, whether actually you want it. Now, I've said countless times that, you know, if you look at devolution, and there's a huge difference, by the way, between devolution and independence. Independence is separation. It's going your own separate way. Devolution is within the United Kingdom. You know, already, in the pipeline, if you like, Scotland will from next year be able to borrow. It'll have responsibility for land tax, stamp duties, and from 2016, it has to fix its own rate of income tax. And my guess is if we all left here and walked down Princes Street and asked the first 100 people, you know, did they know this was happening, they'd probably say they didn't, because it's had very little publicity. I know this profession does, because it's been very exercised about the whole thing. So I have no problem with there being further devolution. It's just that you have to think long and hard about whether or not you want that. And actually, if you go significantly further, at some stage you're going to have to ask the rest of the UK what it thinks. It's not just a one-sided thing, if you like. But as long as you stay in the UK, it wouldn't make any difference to you know, us and the number of MPs. If you leave, then clearly it does make a difference because it would all stop. Which brings me to the last point on the passport question. I honestly don't know the answer because no one's ever sat down to work out how this would happen because it isn't an issue at the moment. We all in this room have UK passports. Now, I have no idea whether we would be allowed to keep our UK passports or whether we, you know, to what extent would you have to prove you had some connection with the rest of the UK to keep it? Or would you have to have a Scottish passport? What I do know is that one of the strengths we have at the moment is that really no matter where you are in the world or where those of you who employ people have your employees in the world, there is usually a British embassy or a British consulate. Now, there's no way a country like Scotland could carry that range of representation. And on a practical basis, when actually, you know, you want a passport, that these things are important. But maybe this is one of the many things that will be answered in the white paper. I honestly don't know. I'd be surprised if it does, because that is when, you know, this when it really comes home to people that this isn't just an idle thing. This actually has practicalities. What nationality do I have after 2014? So it's an important issue, but I'm afraid I can't answer it. It's one of the many unknowns.
Thanks, Alistair. Okay, gentlemen here, and then Robert. So 1, 2, Robert, then 4. Okay. Sorry, it's gentleman here first, Jeff.
Thank you. Brian Langdon. Right at the start of today's session, you said something that intrigued me and interested me. You said it's going to be a far closer run thing than people think. Well, bearing in mind that Alexander's tactic of delaying this and increases to the vote seems to have backfired because it's not a vote of 30s but more, it's like 28-29%. This is going to be close run. It's going to be held against in public opinion to be made by him. Do you think that's going to happen?
Okay, thank you. The gentleman behind there. That's
Captain Corey, some point about uncertainty. A lot of the business community are concerned about uncertainty before the debate and the diversion. What sort of result is removed uncertainty.
And then, gentlemen here, and I'll take these as the last questions.
Alan Robertson, when you're talking about a lot of things are still to be answered in the white paper, now, do you think it's right that we're being asked to take a vote without knowing what the outcome is? Because as I understand it, once you have the vote, we then still have to go through the UK government to actually agree the way forward, so we're voting on something we don't actually know what the outcome is.
Okay.
Right.
I'll take the last one here.
All right. Fine. Fine.
Robert.
Robert Hannigan, thought, and it's following on from that last point. If, as I suspected you're right, we won't have many answers in the white paper, and it does become a very emotional vote, what will be your pitch on that last night when the Braveheart will be in one of the TV channels?
Yeah, they're all related. Let me start with your point first about why we're doing it this way around. And the answer to that is because that's what they decided to do. You know, if you go back to 2011, it's interesting that you know the Nationalists won, but independence wasn't an issue. In fact, we were told time and time again we weren't voting on independence. Needless to say, the day afterwards, it turns out that's exactly what we were voting on. And what the Nationalists said was, we are going to hold a referendum on whether or not Scotland becomes independent. Now, if any of us that day had said, well, actually, you've no right to do that, or we have the discussions first, they'd say, you lost the election, we've got the authority. So they decided to do that. It does mean, though, that an awful lot of things, frankly, we won't know until afterwards, because what Scotland will be voting for is a proposition that would give the present Scottish government the authority to say, look, Scotland wants to go its own way. Now we sit down and we go through the business of breaking up, you know, the country, if you like. They said they can do that in 18 months, which is a very tall order. And certainly in my experience, I expect a lot of you have experienced, if the person you're negotiating with knows that you have a deadline beyond which you cannot pass, you tend not to get such a good deal than if you can sit it out and say, oh, well, you know, we'll come back and look at these things and so on. But, you know, that's the proposition. I think the next thing that you then come on to is, you know, the whole uncertainty point. I said earlier you know, they've only got to win once by one vote, and that's right. If you look at the moment, you know, we have a majority Nationalist government in Scotland, but they're very much a minority of the votes that they got. And this could happen in a referendum. You could get a low turnout, and, you know, they get one more vote than we do, and that's it. Because I don't think you can't have a referendum and then just, you know, try and ignore it. If people have spoken, they've spoken, and that's it. There will be some uncertainty. I've said on numerous occasions, our problem on our side is we've not just got to win, but we've got to win well. Because I think unless you put this to bed for a generation, it's going to come back again and again and again. And when all this is going on, we are not discussing things like health, where, as you know, in parts of Glasgow, people are dying at a younger age than anywhere else in Europe. We have some dreadful health outcomes in parts of Scotland. If you look at education, you know, we often say Scotland's education is great. There's an awful lot that's not great. There's a lot of children coming out of schools who, frankly, don't have the skills that they need to get on and get on in the world. None of these things are going to get discussed for as long as we're discussing constitutional change. And it's so often the default option in Scottish politics is not let's face up to some difficult spending decisions or policy decisions, but let's go and discuss the constitution. So we actually do need to win, and we need to win well, which brings, I suppose, me to the final point. And I'm sorry that it was only my first point that intrigued you. I hope the entire speech would have intrigued you. Why do I say that it's going to be closer than people think? Is firstly, if you look at these things, you know, the turnout will not be, I doubt it will be, you know, uniform. I think it will be differential. If you are a Nationalist and you've believed in this all your life, you will be at the polling station at 5 to 7 on the day the polls open. On the other hand, if you've got yourself into a situation where, you know, you're against the whole thing, but it looks like you're going to win anyway, and if EastEnders has got a particularly gripping tale that night, you might decide just to stay in and not go. Equally, if you look at the turnouts in Scottish elections for the last 10 years, they've been lousy, you know, sometimes under 50%. Now, part of that, we've got to try and enthuse people. Part of it too is to try and persuade people actually it does make a difference to what they're doing. I suppose the final thing that makes me uncertain about these things is that in a referendum, you can never tell that you can never forecast whether something happens, you know, maybe close into the poll that just suddenly changes people's views. You know, you were talking about world affairs. Suppose you've got another thing like, you know, September 11th in the United States, or some great emotional thing happens. It can work both ways, but it is terribly unpredictable, referendums. You know, politicians, although we do have, you know, we welcome elections, we dread them as well, because you can never be too sure what happens when you ask the people, because the people may tell you something you didn't actually want to hear from them. There's a lot of uncertainty here. Just if you look at the polls in the last 24 hours, the one yesterday, you know, shows, you know, us with a huge lead. The one that came out overnight, which I have to say was commissioned by the SNP, which does slightly colour my view on it, you know, it shows that surprisingly, against all expectations and against all other polls, they've suddenly got an increase. My lesson from both these things and my concluding point is, it is all to play for. And you go into a contest like this thinking you're going to win, then you're going to go in for a rude shock, which is why what you think, what you do, what you say does make a real difference. And I just conclude by urging you to make sure you all have your views, you know, whether it's for or against. For goodness sake, don't be afraid to speak up and say, because it does influence your fellow citizens. That's me.
No one can say we're not being even-handed in a debate. We had an equally exciting debate and discussion with Nicola Sturgeon. Alistair, you have done the same. And as I've done on each occasion, I think it is only appropriate to acknowledge our speaker and recognise that these are individuals who are earnest, committed, passionate about what they believe. And I think this is an opportunity for us, because I don't think we've had many events with you, Alistair, over the years, and I suppose we should, as history is doing, acknowledging the significant role you played in what might be said saving our economy. It may be easier doing that than making this 12 months exciting, but we should acknowledge, ladies and gentlemen, the great role you've played. And I did watch you. The more we got to the bit on currency and economy, the more excited you got.
Speaking to a country. Yeah.
And perhaps this is one of the areas, certainly, for where you can speak with authority and gravitas and compel attention. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for coming today. We will continue a journey in these 12 months in relation to the debate. There are other things we want to talk about, but we recognise we need to talk about this one. There will be more public statements from ICAS on a number of policy issues, which may be equally uncomfortable for both sides, but I can absolutely guarantee that we will be speaking in the public interest and hopefully appeal to the man in the street. We didn't quite anticipate our pensions paper would capture the attention of the man in the street, but boy, it did. And I think the public have recognised that here truly is an independent voice. On that topic, we are not finished with our events. You will see, and I would really like to draw your attention, if you'd like to take it in your hand physically, this flyer. We believe we've secured what will probably be the best lineup in the next 12 months on the independence debate. We hope it will coincide with the publication of the white paper. Who knows? But that would be our hope. By the way, that will be a focal point of what we would regard as robust debate. And ladies and gentlemen, I would encourage, it's a half-day conference. We are charging for it. It's not a significant amount, but you could be there contributing to the debate and giving opinion. And I would really encourage you to come along. We also have on the seat a list of the events that we are doing over the next number of months. We are working really hard for you, members of the Institute, to provide a programme of activity that help and enhance you, provide opportunities for networking, and actually show that the Institute and the profession has some very, very good areas of commentary, and also the spectrum of roles that our members have and that we can learn from. So, ladies and gentlemen, I would continue to encourage you to come. It's nice to see a spectrum of membership here. We've got the young and the less young. And I look forward to seeing you at future events. So, ladies and gentlemen, before we go, once again, thank you very much, Alistair Darling.